Luke chapter 10, verse 1 says, after this, the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was about to go. He told them, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Here we have Jesus going around modeling healthy living for all the people who are watching him. They know that he's here with a goal of leading people into a good relationship with God. And now Jesus says to them, you guys know what I'm aiming at, so pray God will send people out there so that it'll happen. And then in his very next sentence, with his very next words, Jesus says, and I mean you. In Luke 10, verse 3, it says, go. Jesus says, go. We had an elder in our congregation who used to say, Christians should do things. When I asked him, like, what kind of things, he said, things, everything, anything, good things, things. Lots of things need to be done in the world. We should be doing things. Kind of what Jesus said. Go. Jesus' half-brother said the same thing. James said, do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but doesn't do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they've heard, but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do. And here Jesus says, okay, enough listening. You guys get the idea. Get out there. You do what I'm doing. And they did. They went out and they told people the good news and they helped people in marvelous ways. And it was great. Luke 10, verse 17 says, the 72 returned with joy. And they said, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. And Jesus replied, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. And I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. However, don't rejoice that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. His guys came back and said, whoa, Jesus. You are not going to believe this, but we told demons to get out, and they did. And Jesus said, well, that's good, but I told Satan to get out, and I watched him fall from heaven. And Jesus said, but what's more important, what you've got going for you that's even better, it's not who's running from you, it's who's claiming you. Jesus said, your names are written in heaven. One guy wrote about that. He said, not what we do for God, but what God does for us. That's the agenda for rejoicing, that your name would be included in God's list. And then Jesus, after that experience, tells one of the greatest stories that's ever been told, one of his most famous ever stories. Our sermon series this year during the 40 days of Lent focuses on Jesus. We've looked at his skill in fixing broken bodies, at his ability to restore fractured friendships, how he turned bad situations into wins for God, how he brought dignity to people who were down and out, how he freed addicts from the demons that possessed them, how he turned a sack lunch into an all-you-can-eat buffet. Our sermon series is about Jesus and how he lived and what he said and who he served and what made him so special. He has been remarkable in so many ways already. You could almost make like a 7-season series about him. And you could show it in theaters, and people might go and watch and say, wow, that's great. But today, I want us to see what an amazing storyteller Jesus is and why that matters. So this story starts off with a guy who's asking Jesus how he can get God to write his name in heaven. In Luke 10, verse 25, it says, on one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? That's a good question. That question is on the minds of people at every funeral I have ever been to. Every time I go to a funeral, people say, they're good, right? The person who died, the person I love, the person who isn't here anymore, they're in heaven, right? They've inherited eternal life, right? This guy asked a good question. And like almost always, Jesus answers this guy's good question by asking him a different question, because he wants to see where this man is coming from, what he knows about God's world. Jesus replied in verse 26, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And the man answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. which is the exact right answer. And we know that it's the exact right answer because when Jesus was asked, what is the most important thing in the law, that's what he said. He said, love God like crazy and love your neighbor like yourself. It is a good answer. It is the exact right answer. And Jesus gives this guy full credit for his answer. And people start to applaud because he got the answer right. But as the guy starts to take a bow, Jesus says, oh, and one other thing. In verse 28, Jesus said, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. See, it's not knowing the answer. It's doing the answer that gets you in. So the guy who thought he had aced the test already suddenly realizes, oh, there's a page two, and he doesn't like that so much. So he says, really? Well, okay, how do you define neighbor? And it's then that Jesus breaks out a story that would be retold for 2,000 years and counting. In verse 30, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, they beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. Now, some background that the guy listening to Jesus might have had that you don't have. Jerusalem was a city on a hill, on top of a hill. Jericho was actually to the north of Jerusalem, but wherever you go from Jerusalem, you're going down. He went downhill to Jericho. And the trip to Jericho from Jerusalem was through nasty mountainous passes where nasty people hung out doing nasty things to people who walked by if you walked by at the wrong time. This road from Jerusalem to Jericho was called Bloody Boulevard or Robber's Road or Attack Avenue or Heaven Help Him Who Heads Here Highway. I worked hard on that one. But for some reason, this guy thinks he's okay heading down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he's going there when he shouldn't go there, and he gets mugged. Did you hear about the guy who went into 7-Eleven to rob the place? So he put a $20 bill on the counter, and he asked for change, and when the cashier opened the drawer to make change, the guy pulled a gun, and he said, give me what's in the drawer. So the cashier did, and the guy fled with the money, having successfully robbed his first store. Except all of the money in the drawer at that moment totaled $15. And he left his 20 on the counter when he ran, which prompted Paul Harvey to ask, so if you point a gun at someone and give them $5, did you commit a crime? This Jericho-bound guy thinks he's safe, maybe because he has no money with him. Apparently, that was the case, but it made the thieves mad. So they beat him bloody, and they took his clothes, because that's all he had, leaving him naked, unconscious, dying. And the people who are listening to this story say, yep, that happens on that road. In fact, that guy might even deserve it a little bit. I mean, you got to be careful on that road. It's sad, but true. So far, Jesus' story is believable and predictable. You could, on jerichosnextdoor.com, the next day it said, saw a terrible accident on the road leading down from Jerusalem the other day. Did anyone else see the man laying there? But in every good story, you get to a part where something surprising happens. In verse 31, Jesus says, a priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. A priest? A man of God? Someone whose life work is to help people see God's goodness, to represent God, to God's people, the most respected person, a priest, the most revered, the most honored. Those guys were considered super holy guys. They were holy. They were handsome. They were healthy. They were kind of like preachers are. They knew how to do life right. They were the role models for everybody. They were great. So when Jesus said a priest saw the guy beaten up and he just walked right on by, people gasped. At Princeton Theological Seminary, back in the 70s, two social psychologists decided to run an experiment. And at this seminary, they asked students to prepare a sermon based on this story from Jesus. And then, after the sermons were written, they sent each student across campus to preach the sermon. But as each student left, they told them, you're late. They're expecting you a few minutes ago. You better hurry to get there. And then, on the way over to where they were supposed to preach this sermon, Each guy walked by a man in an alleyway between the buildings on campus who was moaning. They had hired an actor who was lying there destitute, crouched over, coughing, clearly in need of help. And the experiment was to see how many of the preachers would stop and see if they would help, could help the distressed man or not. 9 out of 10 preachers did not stop and check on the guy. They walked right on by. 9 of 10 did not help a person in need because they had to go preach a sermon about helping people in need. That's not right, right? That's what the people listening to Jesus' story were thinking. A priest walked by this guy? Verse 31, a priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, Jesus says, a Levite, when he came to the place, saw him and passed by on the other side. Jesus doubles down. He says, a Levite, a worship leader, a guy on staff, someone who spends most of his time at a church building. He saw the man and walked around him. And people listening to this story think, they're thinking, what in the world? A priest and a Levite, and neither of them even checks on the guy? This is a crazy story. This is almost unbelievable. Why didn't they stop to help? Shouldn't they help the guy? At least they should have called 911 or something. I mean, the guy probably shouldn't have gone down there, right? We admit that, but you got to see if you can help, right? You can't just leave him lying there on the side of the road. When our son lived in town, one night he was coming up 444 from Bloomfield, and as he came towards Victor, a deer jumped out and just hit the deer hard. In the collision, he smashed his head on the steering wheel, and he stopped his car and got out kind of groggy, and he was just standing there in the middle of the road. Providentially, a policeman had been following him and quickly got him safely to the side of the road. And we thank God for that policeman helping Jess when he was in trouble. But here we have a man bleeding out on the roadside, and good people are just walking right around him. Enter Stage West, the most surprising part of Jesus' whole story. But a Samaritan, he says. Verse 33, but a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. And he said, look after him, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. I cannot really explain the shock that these people must have felt when Jesus first told this story. A Samaritan helped this guy? Wait, what? Like, what? A Samaritan? It's kind of like if a Palestinian protester would show life-saving kindness to a Jewish soldier. It's kind of like a MAGA hat wearer risking his life to help a BLM protester who's in trouble. It's kind of like a Buffalo Bills fan doing anything nice at all for Tom Brady. You think the contrast that we're in that foot washing commercial, he gets us foot washing commercial during the Super Bowl, were rough? The people listening to Jesus probably, when he said Samaritan, they all said, no way. Samaritans hated and were hated by the Jews. They did not do life together. No way. And when Jesus' story not only includes a Samaritan, but makes him the hero of the story, not only did the Samaritan stop, unlike the priest and the Levite, who you'd expect to stop, but he tended to this guy, he transported the guy to safety, he paid for his initial care, and he offered to pay for follow-up as well. That blew their minds. That rocked their worlds. That was a game changer. I mean, what Jesus said was possible. They guessed it could happen, but they just never thought it would. It was a crazy story, which Jesus told to make a point, or rather to ask a question. Jesus told that whole story so he could ask a question. The guy he was talking to had asked Jesus, okay, I'm supposed to love my neighbor? Who dat? Who's my neighbor? I'm willing to play your game, Jesus. Define neighbor. And then Jesus tells this story, and then Jesus asks a question. He says, which of these? You tell me. Verse 36, which of these three do you think was neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? And the expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." The guy talking with Jesus did not say the Good Samaritan, which is too bad for him, because if he would have said that, he would have earned a lot of royalties over the years. He did not come up with that name. He wouldn't say that name. He didn't want to say Samaritan. But more than collecting royalties, this would have been an aha moment for him if he would have said it. But he could not answer. He had to say what the answer, he had to say, Jesus' story was pretty obvious. You had to pick the right guy, but he didn't want to say Samaritan. The best he could muster, the one who had mercy on him. And once again, like Jesus did in the beginning of the conversation, Jesus gives this guy an A for his answer and an assignment. Jesus said, "You're right. The neighbor was the one who had mercy on the man in need. Do that." So your neighbor, are you here? The neighbor, according to Jesus, is anyone in your path today who needs your help. In fact, it's anyone who needs your help. And you say, "But there are so many people who need help, like everybody, and I don't even know them all." Pretty sure the Samaritan in Jesus' story didn't know the man who was bleeding, but he knew he needed help. You say, "But sometimes people with needs are kind of inconvenient." I agree. Actually, helping people is almost always inconvenient. But the Samaritan stopped what he was doing and helped. You say, "But if other people don't help, then I don't have to, right?" And I'm guessing that probably the Samaritan could see the dust in the distance. The priest and the Levite had walked by. He knew that other people had chosen not to help, but he stopped and helped anyway. You say, "But sometimes helping people gets messy." And that's so true in so many ways. The Samaritan bandaged the guy and put clothes on him and laid the bloody man on his donkey. You say, "But sometimes it's not safe to help people." And the Samaritan probably realized that the muggers might still be somewhere nearby. And you say, but you don't expect me to help if it costs me my money, right? But the Samaritan paid the innkeeper for the room. And you say, "But I don't have to, if I have to help, okay, fine, but I don't have to keep helping, right?" But the Samaritan said, "I'll be back and I'll pay for more." And you say, "But sometimes people are in trouble because they make bad choices. Should I still help them?" And I think that one's harder. Should we help people whose trouble, ongoing trouble, is their own fault? And based on this story, and based on the arc of Jesus' life story, it would seem that Jesus' answer would be, yes, we should still help. Of course we help people who have gotten themselves into messes, Jesus would say, because that's all of us. And Jesus' point and Jesus' practice is that we are to help anyone in our path who is in need. We are to help. We are always to help. We are to help those in need. Whether that's costly or hard or inconvenient or dangerous or repetitive, we who follow Jesus are called to help people in need. That is the point of the story. He told us this story because we need to know that. We need to do that. We need to help. But sadly, I have a footnote here. The goal of helping is to get people to become what God made them to be. And our job is always to be open to helping people move in that direction. But sometimes people choose not to move in that direction. Sometimes disconnecting or removing the natural consequences of people's choices does not lead them in the way that they should go. Rabbi Edwin Friedman tells about a guy on a journey through mountains one night, and as he crossed a bridge, he saw a stranger coming towards him, and it looked like, as the man approached him, that he was reaching out to shake hands. It turns out he was holding out the end of a rope, and the other end of the rope was wrapped around that man's waist. And the stranger handed the man the rope, asked him to hold it. The guy didn't understand, but he grabbed the rope, and the stranger asked him to hold tightly with two hands, which he did, and then the man jumped over the bridge. His weight surprised him, nearly pulled the guy off the bridge with him, but he held on, and he's standing there on top of the bridge holding a guy who's dangling over a chasm. And the guy on the bridge, struggling to hold the rope, yells, what are you doing? And the dangling guy says, "Just hold tight." And the man on the bridge tries to pull him up, but he can't. And he says, why did you do that? And the end of the rope guy says, if you let go, I will be lost. And the man on the bridge said, but I can't pull you up. And the stranger yells, just hold on. I need you to hold on. And the guy on the bridge looks around for help, but nobody's there. It's just them. And he says, please, I can't hold you. Please climb back up here. And the dangling man says, no, I am your responsibility. And the bridge man said, no, I didn't ask for this. And the stranger cried, if you let go, I am lost. And the man tied to the rope, he tried to tie the rope to the bridge, but he couldn't let go long enough to get it tied around, so he couldn't do that. He yelled down, why'd you do this? This is crazy. What are you thinking? Get up here. And the man said, just remember, my life is in your hands. Time went by. The man's arms grew more and more tired. He thought, well, if the stranger tried to climb the rope, I could probably pull against the railing. We'd probably get him back up here. But when he suggested that, the man was not interested. And the man on the bridge said, you mean you won't help? But I told you I can't pull you up by myself. I don't think I can hold on much longer. And the dangler said, you must try. If you fail, I will die. More time went by, and his strength waned. Finally, the guy on the bridge said, listen, I can no longer accept the decision for your life, only the decision for mine. I am giving you your life back. And the guy hanging over the gorge said, what do you mean by that? And the man on the bridge said, I mean, it's up to you. You decide which way this will end, but it is your choice. I will help you, but only if you will help you. And the dangler said, you can't mean what you're saying. You wouldn't be that selfish. I am your responsibility. How could you let someone die? Don't do this to me. And the bridge man said, I will no longer stand here and hold the rope. If you want to live, you must start moving now, and I will help you get back up. Please, start moving now. And knowing he was nearly exhausted, the man on the bridge waited a few more minutes, but there was no change in the tension of the rope. So he finally yelled down, very well, I accept your choice. And he let go and he walked on. When I first heard that story, I didn't believe it. I thought, that's not a good story. That's not right. That's wrong somehow. We should never give up. We should always help, no matter what. We should always, always, always help. But folks, even God can only help people if they decide they want to be helped. In Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul says, at a certain point, and this is a horrifying thought, but at a certain point, eventually, God gives people over to the choices they make. At a certain point, Romans 1 says, God lets go of the rope. And we're not God. We don't see everything as clearly as he does, which is why if you're trying to help someone who keeps on making wrong choice after wrong choice after wrong choice, no matter how much you try to help them, learn not to do that. That's why we need to ask God for wisdom from above in how long we should keep on holding on. And this is one of the really sad parts of free will, I think. But in the end, we cannot make other people's choices. We cannot make them do what they should do. I wish we could. After 40 years of doing this, I so wish I could make people make better choices, but we can't. But the big picture overall is that we are to help. We are to help anyone in need as much as we can, if we can, as far as they'll let us, we are to help. You know what the parable of the Good Samaritan teaches, right? Yes, you do. Everybody does. People who have preached this know what it means. People who have just heard it for the first time know what this story means. Kids know what it means. The amazing thing about Jesus is that he summarized one of the most important things in life in a simple story that you can carry around with you wherever you go for the rest of your life. And the world would be so much better if we would just help each other and do what we know he says we should do. The doctor said to the patient, your problem is that you sit too much. And the patient said, I understand. And the doctor said, exactly. We say we understand the story of the Good Samaritan, but if we don't do it, starting now, do we understand? Imagine if nations in the world would help each other instead of attacking each other. Imagine if politicians would prioritize helping citizens instead of themselves. Imagine if churches would choose to work with each other for the good of the kingdom. Imagine if, instead of antagonizing each other, husbands and wives would serve one another. If instead of being a law that is passed to protect people who try to help others, imagine if Good Samaritan was an apt description of how we all lived our lives. What a world this would be. If we could even get siblings to do this. I have one more story. It's about a preacher and his two sons. This is a true story. The three of them went fishing. The father took his two sons, age 7 and 11, fishing. Son number one baited his hook and threw it in the water. The father baited son number two's hook and threw it in the water. Within a minute, the younger son caught a fish. And to his brother, he said, "Russ, I got one." And his older brother said, "Way to go, Phil." And the father rebaited son number two's hook, and the son threw it in again. And again, immediately, he caught a fish. And to his brother, he said, "Russ, I got another one. I got two." This time, the older brother didn't say anything, but he threw his line a little closer to where his brother was catching the fish. The younger son then caught the third fish, and then a fourth, and then a fifth. And he started getting a little cocky. And he said, "Hey, Russ, I've caught five. I got five fish. How many you got, Russ?" And the older brother said, "Dad, tell him to shut up, not talk about how many fish he got." So the father said to his younger son, "Phil, don't talk about how many fish you got. It's making your brother feel bad." But the younger son started to sing a little song. He sang, "I went fishing and I caught five fish. I went fishing and I caught five fish." The older brother said, "Dad, tell him to quit singing that song." Father said, "Phil, quit singing that song. You're making your brother feel bad." So Phil started humming it. The older son said, "Dad, tell him to quit humming it. I know the words to that song. Tell him to stop." Dad said, "Phil, quit humming that song." Father looked over a couple of minutes later, and the younger son was just bopping his head. And the older boy said, "Dad, make him stop bopping his head. I know what he's thinking." And the father said, "Okay, that's it. We're done. Two of us are not having any fun here. We're done." And they left. When I heard that story, I thought, how perfectly that describes how often we do life. We can relate to everybody in that story. The older son's not getting any, very frustrated, jealous, unhappy, not good. Younger son, wildly lucky, good stuff falling in his lap. He's so happy and totally oblivious to his brother's hurt. The father's just wishing his kids would enjoy the good that he's trying to dump on them. The secret to life, folks, the secret to life being enjoyed the way God intended you to enjoy life requires loving your neighbor. This is what it means to live life, to help those who are in need. And Jesus's genius was that he packed that truth into a story that is so easily told and understand that we can teach it to toddlers in our Bible school classes. Jesus was such a great storyteller that even young kids can learn the key to living life from the very beginning. And the key goes like this. If you can help, help. If you see a need and you can meet it, meet it. If you have an opportunity to move someone ahead in his or her journey towards Jesus, do that thing. And in this way, we help the kingdom of this world become the kingdom of our Lord. And we can rejoice that our names are written in heaven. Let's pray.